Hello, friends. We're down to the last few days to vote for the Sewers of Paris for a 2016 Podcast Award. You can vote once per day, now through June 12th. If you enjoy the show, just go to podcastawards.com, find the GLBT category, and vote for the Sewers of Paris. Thanks. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Brian Safi says...
I always want to have really good points, and I want to find the dumbest way to get there.
The topic is Big Business, Tori Amos, and Heathers. I hope you already know this week's guest, Brian Safi, from the fantastic podcast Throwing Shade, which he co-hosts with Aaron Gibson. Every week, Brian and Aaron disrespectfully deconstruct issues of importance to ladies and gays, and it is the very first thing I listen to whenever there's a new episode. It's also, incidentally, coming to your town, possibly. Brian and Aaron are on a 21-city tour right now, and tickets are on sale at throwingshade.com/tour. As a flamboyant kid in Texas, humor was Brian's protection in situations where standing out might otherwise have been risky. He escaped to the big city he's always dreamed of to become an actor, and for a time he tried to peel off that funny armor by taking on serious roles. But stripping down revealed something he didn't expect. Underneath the humor that he once hid behind was a man who was even funnier. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm Matt Baum. I'm joined today by Brian Safi from the Throwing Shade podcast and also Young and Hungry on ABC Family. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. Like I said before, I've long been a fan of yours and you do great work and I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of yours as well. Mutual admiration. What is the entertainment that changed your life?
Big Business. Did you ever see that movie with Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler?
It's been so long, and every time I see it like pop up on Facebook or someone's feed, I'm like, oh, I really need to see this again.
Yeah, it Big Business has been there for me a lot in my life, specifically. So when I was very young, and we would go to rent a movie with my family, everything was always rented out. And the three that we always stuck to were Steel Magnolias. By the way, my whole family, like my brother, my parents, like everyone. Steel Magnolias, Dead Poets Society, and Big Business. And Big Business was the one for me. Actually, my best friend Jesse and I share this in common, was the first movie that made me decide, oh, I want to live in New York City. It's all set in New York. It's all like high glam. And it was also the first time that I understood that there were two gay characters in a movie. They were evil, of course, but I remember thinking like, oh, and there were suggestions of them having sex. And that was like the first time that everything sort of awoke inside me of you know, my potential and probable and definite gayness.
And that you'd move to New York and have sex and thwart the plans of these fabulous women.
Exactly. Who each one, Bette Midler plays identical twins and Lily Tomlin plays identical twins. So it was also like a feat of technology.
Yeah. So describe what this movie is for people who aren't familiar.
So this movie is just a switched at birth sort of scenario that Bette Midler is born as identical twins to a very rich family. Lily Tomlin is born to identical twins to a very poor family. They somehow, the mothers end up in the same hospital giving birth. The twins are switched. So two grow up in New York and run this mega huge sort of like pharmaceutical company. And then the other two end up in the country. So there's essentially city Bette Midler, city Lily Tomlin, country Bette Midler, country Lily Tomlin. And they all end up meeting in New York for like this big takedown conference thing. And, you know, hijinks ensue, basically.
They're clones. What a cheap trick.
It's clones, people! I saw that movie. I was at the premiere.
Get back. Get back!
There is no such thing as pod people, is there?
You're not my sister.
And you're not my sister.
Thank God.
Sure. Mistaken identity and a lot of like waving at themselves and what they think is a mirror.
There's so much mirror work in this movie. There's an entire sequence where they're like putting on lip gloss and thinking it's a mirror and then get scared. And it's so out of control. But their performances are just excellent. And the two sort of henchmen cronies who are like trying to take them down are these sort of two side character gay guys who are a couple, are, you know, hysterically always mistaken for best friends and blah, blah, blah. And also, when I came out to my mom, Big Business was on the counter when that happened, years and years later. My VHS copy of Big Business witnessed all of it. So it's played a big part.
It's like your guardian angel.
It truly was. I think I even had the poster at one point, like in college, hanging up in my room. It certainly did a lot for me. And it was like the first time that I had ever heard of like the Plaza Hotel and Central Park. And it really was the thing that made me. I lived in New York for years. I went to college there. And it was like the thing that made me go there. Which I guess is, I don't know, maybe pathetic, but it worked.
I can't imagine that the makers of the film like had that in mind. They're like, this is going to make everyone want to move to New York City.
I doubt they thought it was basically a tourism ad for New York City, but it certainly was to me. And Bette Midler, of course, I feel like what I love about Bette Midler is no matter like what movie she's in, she'll work in a song somehow. And in this one, there's like street performers in New York City playing, and the country Bette Midler just starts yodeling with him. And it's a full 2 minutes of her singing a yodeling song.
That is magical.
It pretty much is.
I mean, and it's impossible to imagine any other two actresses in these roles.
No, it really isn't. And they both just truly nail it, because Bette Midler always like runs the risk of being sort of too larger than life in a movie. But this movie is so like slapstick and silly and over the top that it like suits her perfectly. And Lily Tomlin, who's better at developing a character than her. And she just, I don't know. It really is just, it's a total feat. It is a 4-star feat of technology, imagination, character work, acting, tourism, everything.
It's the whole package.
It really is.
So how old were you when you were, it sounds like you were watching this movie kind of repeatedly.
Oh yeah. It was so that kid thing of, and I guess they've like done studies about this, that the reason kids, I think it was probably 7. Or 8, maybe. I think the reason kids become obsessed with movies and watch them over and over and over and over again is because literally, and I hate using that word, except this time it's true, literally every time they watch it, they see something brand new in it. And it the meaning changes for them constantly, which is why, like, you know, kids watch, like, Teletubbies for, like, you know, the same episode for, like, a year, because they're constantly learning from it. And so Big Business was my Teletubbies, and I watched it probably twice a week. Even though we never owned it, I would say, like, the rotation, like I said, was Steel Magnolias, Dead Poets Society, Big Business. And Big Business is still the one that, like, first of all, it was really the only one with a happy ending of those three movies.
That's true.
The other two really aren't kids' movies.
Yeah.
I think one ends in suicide, one ends with diabetes. So it was definitely the most cheerful of those. And so I think that's why it had such an impact. And also just in my sort of journey of becoming a comedian, it was very influential, because I basically just did impressions of them in that movie constantly for my family. I think I knew every single line. Yeah, it just was so influential on me and in my career, certainly in my personal life, and certainly in recognition of myself.
So were you doing comedy aside from just reciting this one movie? Were you like the funny kid at the time?
I was. I definitely was the sort of always acting out, and always really trying to make people laugh. I think that was certainly my coping mechanism was doing, and it was always sort of impressions. Like if I had gone to the bank with my mom that day, if I was sitting in the car with her and she'd gotten frustrated with the attendant and it had put her in a bad mood, I would do an impression of the attendant, or I would go home and do that impression of that exchange for my family, and they loved it. It was sort of like the original roast. I would basically just like roast my family at a very young age, and they would laugh. And I think that was also certainly all through school. I was never really, I was very guarded, but I wasn't introverted. I don't think I let anything personal ever really come out, because I was just so afraid. I knew instantly that I was gay. I knew very early, but I didn't come out until I was 21 to most people. But I knew that entire time. And so I think I was very extroverted, very loud, always, you know, definitely distracting in class, trying to, you know, class clown kind of behavior. I also was just not letting anyone in to know sort of what I was. And I think the first time I noticed, and this is like a deep cut, but I remember when I was very young, it was like a friend's birthday party, and we went to like this like 50s diner to get milkshakes or something. Everyone ordered chocolate or vanilla, and I remember I ordered strawberry, and there was like a hush. And I remember my mom told me that night never to stand out like that, which was just like crazy because it was just like a flavor I liked. But I think she got afraid. And so I think I knew then sort of what to keep inside and what to keep, you know, what I could reveal.
Boy, but what a, like, a trigger for people to, like, for, like, the record scratch and the room to stop. And, like, that,
yeah.
How could you know that, like, oh, Strawberry is a bridge too far?
Isn't that crazy? I just remember it being, because I feel like all that stuff is, I don't think the kids it was a record scratch, but it definitely was. Like, knowing looks with the adults in that situation. God. And, like, my mom being very uncomfortable about it. And then I remember, you know, sort of that speech. And also, I don't mean to, like, throw my mom under the bus. I think it was well-meaning. I think she was just sort of like, oh, God, I don't want you to get made fun of. But it was the sort of the first thing of, like, oh, maybe don't stand out like that.
You know, I just watched the trailer. Do you know this movie, Norman, Is That You?
No.
Oh, it's this bizarre artifact from the 1970s with, I want to say, Red Fox, where his son, he gets in a fight with his wife, and his adult son is living in Los Angeles, so he just shows up at his adult son's doorstep. And the trailer has the narrator saying, his son Norman used to be an all-American boy, but now he's got purple drapes.
Oh, my God.
Norman used to be the all-American boy. Now, he has purple drapes, florid underwear, and a roommate named Garson.
Oh, fabulous!
I hope that's the story that my family told people was, you know, Brian was fine, and then one day he ordered a strawberry milkshake, and then everyone is just like, oh, sure. That's amazing. Purple drapes.
There's one in every family.
That's right.
What was it like stuff like that was keeping you in? Like, why did it take until you were 21?
I think it was, I also grew up in a very religious family. And I think the fear of God was put in me for sure. I also went to a Christian school. So I was really going to church 6 days out of the week. The only day I wouldn't go was Saturday. And I don't know. I think my parents were not sort of cool Christians. Much cooler now, but at the time they weren't. And I think I really was just afraid, genuinely afraid until an age where it was too old to be, genuinely afraid of like an afterlife situation, like a burning in hell sort of deal. And it was really everyone else in my family, including my grandparents and certainly two of my aunts who just sort of said, they were the ones who told me, my aunt especially told me when I guess I was like 18, I know you're gay. And I think you know that too. And you know, you explore that when you're ready to explore it, but it is A-okay. It is the right path to be on because it's, you know, true to yourself and blah, blah, blah. And then my grandparents essentially said the same thing. Religion, it was growing up. I mean, I grew up in El Paso, Texas, which is a fairly, you know, it's a city for sure, but I grew up in a very, on the west side of town and within the west side of town, it definitely felt like a small place to grow up because I wasn't really near any of the city parts of it. So I think it was all those things combined.
Was it like the little small town suburb of Edward Scissorhands where it's just like...
It was exactly like that, except more spread out because it was like ranches. There was no sort of city feel. The only city feel I ever got was from Big Business. But yeah, so I don't know. I was just, I think, very afraid. And also at the time, I remember hearing from people that if I wanted to work in entertainment, I couldn't be gay. I remember that black bar watching the Ellen sitcom growing up. At least in Texas, they had a warning sign before that episode started.
Ellen's next on ABC.
This program contains adult content. Parental discretion is advised.
We have everything we need to cook dinner?
We have sauce and spaghetti, and I think I have water at home.
I think Will and Grace was just getting going at that time. So it I don't know. I think I was afraid of working in entertainment, afraid of God or the wrath of it. And I think, you know, sort of didn't want to let my parents down either. It was all those things.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Like, even after I came out and my parents were totally fine with it, my dad works in HIV counseling for the CDC.
Wow.
And, like, they could not have been more supportive. He had so many gay coworkers. But, like, I was telling myself this story, like, even after I came out, oh, they're really mad. Even
yeah.
Though they were just fine. They're really mad.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there really is no other feeling I would say that, through most of your life, of letting your parents down or your parents being mad at you, that they're really, that's a low feeling. And I think that growing up, you really try to, you know, you're trying to avoid that at all costs, and a lot of times to the detriment of you personally. And so I think that was all at play.
Sure. And it sounds like you also had a method of really earning parental approval through making them laugh.
For sure. And I still, and you know, and I can catch sometimes myself still doing that, of like being like, uh-oh, we're going into territory that not everyone's comfortable with, make a joke, but sort of try to stop doing that more, just because, I don't know, Oprah, et cetera.
Well, and it's a lot of work, too.
It is, because then you're just like constantly on guard.
So was like, what was the persona that you had of like, you know, when you're funny Brian and making everybody laugh, and how far was that from actual Brian?
Funny Brian was really, because I would say in high school, I'll talk about mostly, I definitely was, if you just categorize it into popular versus unpopular, I was probably on the lowest rung of popular. I did fit in because I really worked to fit in, all survival skills at play. And I just didn't really have much faith in myself at that time to really be fine with being a nerd. But I really did have sort of this secret, even with like my music tastes, like when everyone was listening to Nirvana, I was obsessed with Hole. I was obsessed with Bjork. I was obsessed with Tori Amos, which I don't know. Those are like sort of three very different tones of what a gay person can listen to in their lives. It's three very strong women expressing themselves very differently. I really kept even all that, like the music taste stuff, hidden, and would go to like gross, like Dave Matthews Band concerts with my friends. It definitely felt very separate. And by the way, I don't know if this is going too far, I was so not wanting to go there at that point in my life that I didn't even like get myself off until I was, I think, a sophomore in college, which is insane.
Sounds like you had a lot of guilt just kind of weighing you down.
So much guilt. And I think just really feeling like, oh, I really, you know, really, really working hard to fit in. And then really after I came out, I mean, it was, for me at least, a very floodgate kind of thing. I feel like I, like, zero fucks given. And I've sort of been operating on zero fucks given ever since, or trying to.
what's the shift? What made you come out?
Well, I was forced out. My mom was visiting me. And I was dating someone at the time, and she found something, like a letter that he had written me, and she found it. And, well, found it. She looked for it. There definitely was looking involved, because that thing was pretty well hidden. But, so that was it. So I sort of had to. And then that was sort of my biggest fear over. And it didn't go well at all. It certainly wasn't the way I would have planned it, but, you know, I definitely felt even that second, I felt better. Wow. Just because it was over.
So was it like you came back and she confronted you?
Exactly. Oof. Yeah. It was rough. It was not, you know what though? I really have to say, I was secure in myself in so many ways by the time I graduated college, really except in that way. All my close friends knew. I went to NYU, so all of them knew. But really, it was just my family who didn't. And that was really if it hadn't happened that way, I don't know when I would have done it. I certainly would have done it, but it would have been much later. I don't think I would have even been ready a year later to tell them.
Yeah, I can't remember where I heard this, but and it's probably, like, I'm going to be quoting something, and it's probably something super embarrassing, like it was a Pepsodent commercial or something.
Sure.
But there was someone who said, you're going to have to do this before you're ready to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true, because I can't imagine. And by the way, I know there were plenty of people in my town. The only gay people I knew, like confirmed gay, were all people who had left their families because they were gay. That was the only reference I had growing up, was that these were people who wrecked their families. And hearing those stories from my parents of, like, you know, they left their wife, and look at her now, and look at the kids, and it'll never be the same for them, and blah, blah, blah. So they were always villainized on screen and off for me. I didn't want to certainly become one of those guys. I don't think I ever would have, but you know what I mean. It definitely was better to happen before I was ready.
Did you have models, like growing up in El Paso, of, oh, this is what gay people are, and oh my God, I can't be that?
Yeah, villains. Villains and hairdressers. And even with the hairdressers, it was really the kind of thing, like I remember people saying, like even friends of my parents saying, oh, well, you know, I guess he's technically gay, but I don't think he's ever acted on it. Like, it was so just pathetic and sad. It's much different now, I think, probably nationwide, but back then it really was. There was no role model. I mean, another person who, not necessarily gayish, just other, was the original Hairspray, the John Waters Hairspray. I also used to watch over and over and over again because I could not believe that a man was playing a woman. I was like thrown off so hard by it. And I just watched it over and over and over and over again.
Could you turn that racket down? I'm trying to iron in here.
Do you remember how you found Hairspray?
It was on, my mom had the Today Show on, and Ricky Lake was being interviewed right when that movie came out. And I remember, like, looking through the paper to see when it would come, and it never did come to the theaters there. And then, like, a year later, it said at the video store that we went to, coming, like, titles coming soon, and Hairspray was on there. And I was so excited. And so I just started renting it. And by the way, like, even birthday parties with, like, just like slumber parties I would have with, you know, that was at that time, like, all dudes, we would play like flag football and then come home. And at my slumber parties, we watched Hairspray every year with those guys.
Wait, like the flag football kids?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And like kids that age, like we'd watch like The Goonies and Hairspray. And like everyone was like, yay. Like, it was great.
An amazing double bill.
Totally. Totally. And I don't think anyone even, that was such a, like, a deep secret, was like, oh, they're not going to believe it when I say that that's a man playing, you know, Tracy Turnblad's mother. And then I would tell them and no one could believe it.
I love that it's kind of like, for a moment, like your mask drops and you're like, here you go, guys, this is the real me. And I mean, who doesn't love Hairspray? So it's okay.
I know. Yeah. Especially that one, because there's no, that really, this is a dumb thing to say, but Hairspray truly is a movie for all ages, because it really is sort of the safest of the, it's just such a great entry point into something being a little off, mm-hmm. if that's what you're craving.
When someone is asking, like, I just had this conversation with someone who'd never seen any John Waters. And so there's kind of a litmus test of, you know, testing somebody of, like, well, would you like Hairspray better or Serial Mom? Because those are the two. Those are the two that you can enter into the John Waters averse.
You're right, because they look like real movie. You know what I mean? There's nothing cheap about either one of those. And yeah, I feel like if two people, I remember actually, that's my brother was visiting home from college and I showed him Serial Mom. And I was like, I feel like this is a movie that, like, I would love to write one day. And then we watched it and he was just like, not horrified, really confused. This is what you want to do? Like, this is inspirational for you, that a grown woman is prank calling another grown woman and calling her a pussy face? Like, this is something.
Hello?
Is this the cocksucker residence?
God damn you, stop calling here.
Isn't this 4215 Pussy Way?
You bitch!
Now let me check the zip code. 212 fuck you!
Were there, it sounds like there were people around you who were just like, I don't get it.
Oh, everyone. Really, the inspiration when I was young was, my real life inspirations were all the women in my family. My aunt, for instance, she got Hairspray and she got Serial Mom and she took me to see, you know, rated R movies. And she was the one who showed me Heathers and was like, I think you'd really like this. And so I was really lucky in that way to be from, you know, there's certainly a line of very strong, very opinionated, very kooky Texas women that sort of surrounded me when I was younger. And so that really, those were the ones, with the exception of my mom, who was like them, but because I was her son, it was a different relationship. But they were the ones who really, I don't know, that was sort of my entry point into the culture I loved was through them.
I would love for you to describe what Heathers is for the poor kids who have never heard of it.
Oh, God. I mean, Heathers is the meanest Mean Girl. It is Mean Girls kicked up to such an extreme, about a group of girls all named Heather who rule the school. Winona Ryder plays one of their friends who sort of gets in with them, but is also kind of the Lindsay Lohan of Mean Girls, sort of a little bit of an outsider. They end up just sort of going on a killing spree of some of the Heathers and then other people in the school.
If you're going to openly be a bitch...
It's just Heather. Why can't we talk to different kinds of people?
Fuck me gently with a chainsaw. Do I look like Mother Teresa? If I did, I probably wouldn't mind talking to the geek squad.
Did you see that? Heather number one just looked right at me.
Does it not bother you that everybody in this school thinks that you're a piranha?
Like I give a shit. They all want me as a friend or a fuck. I'm worshipped Westerberg. And I'm only a junior.
It is the darkest, meanest, funniest. I saw that movie again recently, and it still shocks me how dark that movie goes. How really, like, there, especially the end of that movie is not funny. It's legitimately bizarre, scary, crazy, but I remember Winona Ryder said something like, there was an interview with her recently or a couple years ago where she said, I feel like I've done the best movie of every genre that there is, which is a lot to say, but she was like, I did the best teen movie ever made, which she's right. Heathers is the best teen movie ever made. And then she said something like, I did an exceptional period piece, which was like The Age of Innocence, which whatever, and exceptional fantasy movies, which was like, you know, Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands. And I was like, you are right. You've done an exceptional line of movies. But yeah, Heathers is sort of the meanest Mean Girls. It's wonderful.
It's not just like, oh, it's not like a gory murder movie. It's just like the darkness of the human soul is exposed.
People, I think, would be so sensitive about this movie now, and maybe they were then, but like the theme of the movie is also teen suicide and making sort of fun of the hype that goes along with something like that. You know, certainly now, when that is such a real prevalent issue, I don't think people would ever want to make fun of that now. So it really is like, that movie continues to get bolder and bolder and bolder.
It's something that feels more dangerous as time goes on.
Yeah. That movie probably came out, what, like late 80s, I would imagine? By the time I saw it, I was in high school, so it was years later. And then I remember thinking like, oh my God, this is so funny and so weird and so great. And then when I saw it again recently, I was like, this is so funny and so weird. It is, like you said, it is a dangerous movie. There are parts of it that I'm like, wow, I don't remember it going this dark.
Was there, you know, I know you said that it was important for you to fit in and be popular. When you found comedy influences like that, did you feel kind of a conflict of like, well, this is maybe not the most mass market or the most popular appealing thing to joke about, but like, it sounds like the jokes that you wanted to tell were a little bit more offbeat than you know, like, I don't know, Jay Leno.
Oh, absolutely. I was obsessed with those movies. I was obsessed with Sandra Bernhardt. Which none of that stuff was, yeah, I guess what you would call in the mainstream, certainly not in high school. Hashtag no regrets, but I do wish I had really been, I really wish I had hung with a little more with like the Outcasts, because I would have had so much to talk about in high school instead of sort of not living a double life. That sounds so seedy, because there was really no sense of myself except what I thought was funny. That was really the only thing that I felt really secure in. But I wish I hadn't tried to put on that stuff so much to fit in. And I'm at least glad I was able to shed all of it by the end of college.
I dated one boy when I was in high school.
You did?
I did.
Good for you.
We essentially broke up because I revealed to his chagrin that I like Monty Python, and he just hated it. And that was, I made us rent, what was it? I think it was Holy Grail. It was Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Right.
And we watched it. He fell asleep halfway through it. And I was like, maybe this relationship isn't the strongest.
Oh, God. I love that. I love that at that age. Just like something like that really being the nail in the coffin. I remember one of my first gay friends broke up with the guy he was dating because he liked Jewel. And I was just like, it's so funny. It's just, because I guess through that culture, you're really forming your identity. So it's more important to you than ever.
Oh, yeah. Like in your teens, like the stuff that you like says so much more about you because you don't know who you are. So you have to define it by, I'm a little piece of this song and a little piece of this movie.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure I said I could never be into someone who didn't like Bjork. I guarantee you that left my mouth at some point. I remember when I moved into college, someone on the floor of my dorm having a Bjork poster, and then someone else saying, oh, I like your poster, da da da. And I was like, oh my God, this is the best. I'm going to love everyone here. But talk about mind being blown. And I remember even just, I'm sure this is everyone's college experience or many people's, but like sitting in a room listening to music that you have listened to at home that no one else liked, and everyone loves it. Like, people talking about how brilliant Courtney Love is. I tried to have that conversation in my life before, and everyone was like, she's crazy. It is funny to like define yourself and to break up with people over what you're into. It's so beautiful.
And Bjork and Tori in particular are like, you know, it makes a very particular statement when you have those albums.
It really does. What do you think that statement is? Because those were the two for me. I would love to articulate what that is, but you're absolutely right. It is such a kind of person, of someone who is, I guess, emotional and wants to be, I don't know, and who also appreciates the abstract. I don't know. It's just weird. And then when you think back on it, you're like, God, how I could not have been more of a cliche. I mean, like,
I think with Tori, they're doing something. They're both doing something different. But I think with Tori, it's that I have a lot of feelings.
I have the most feelings, yeah.
And I see through the veil, I see through the facade of the world.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so just pat on your back. You get what they don't. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful to live there. And I think actually that's a common denominator for Bjork too. Like that sort of idea of like, oh, I get it. I get what this is and I understand this and I think her voice is beautiful. And
her voice, legitimately, she is an amazing singer.
Yeah. And by the way, both of them veer into territory where those songs become like so steeped in metaphor that they're just silly. But at the time, you don't recognize that. Like, Tori Amos is talking about, like, I don't even know, like, rockets and fairies in her vagina. You know what I mean? It's like, gets so insane. And it just sounds almost like gibberish. And Bjork's kind of doing the same thing. And I think it is just that thing of like, well, I think she's talking about this and really loving that.
You know, and I love that we already brought up Jewel because I had a friend in high school who was obsessed with Jewel and everything was about Jewel and Jewel's book of poetry.
Yeah.
About how deep she was.
Yeah. A Knight Without Armor. That's what that was called.
Do you remember like the favorite Bjork and Tori songs that you had?
Okay, yeah. Well, Bjork for me, the album Homogenic was the tippity top. That was just sort of the peak, and I think that came out. I think maybe when I was a freshman in college, that came out. For Tori, I think it was Boys for Pele. And by the way, also when you look back, was the one that was the weird. This I don't want to say silly because that sounds so dismissive, but the one that is the most gibberish-ish.
Hello, Mr. Zebra. Can I have your sweater? 'Cause it's cold, cold, cold in my hole, hole, hole. Ratatouille, strychnine. Sometimes she's a friend of mine with a gigantic whirlpool that will blow your mind.
What are you talking about? like, in the springtime of his voodoo and, like, you know, all those crazy putting the damage on, like all those weird, I got some horses to ride on, and you're just like, oh yeah, I get it. But those were the two, and I think Boys for Paley maybe came out a little earlier, and then Homogenic came out, but those were the two for me. And then that Courtney Love album, the whole album, Live Through This, was the first time I had ever heard anything that raw. That was the triumvirate for me, was those three things.
And it's great, because like you say, they're three strong women who are singing in very different ways.
Very different ways, expressing themselves in destructive, poetic, and bizarre ways.
So were you, when you went away to college in New York, you said you went to NYU. Were you going for performance?
I was, yeah. I was, I went to become an acting major. The track that everyone did, so there's different studios at NYU. I was in the Strasberg Institute, which was sort of the method training. Really didn't like it, and then switched over to experimental theater. Because in experimental theater, you could create your own work, you could write and perform. And so that was sort of, ended up being the thing that really clicked for me. But really the thing that clicked for me is my senior year of college, I started taking classes at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is, you know, a big comedy theater in New York and LA. And that is what really, I mean, I could have almost, except that college was super fun. And obviously that's where I learned so much about myself and got all these friendships. But career and professionally, when I took that improv class at Upright Citizens Brigade, that's when I was like, oh, I could have skipped all those classes. This is what I want to do. And that's cemented everything for me.
Now, I'm just going to note that at a time in your life when you were very guarded and throwing up a lot of masks, that method was unappealing to you, possibly.
Oh, man. You are right.
Yeah.
You are right. That is, because it didn't click for me, and it clicked for plenty of people in my class. And yeah, wow, you are right.
But it sounds like Upright Citizens was sort of a back door into expressing something in a way that was a little bit more approachable for you.
Absolutely, because I think it just came. Listen, I mean, with improv, you don't, I mean, UCB's whole thing is, their whole mantra is don't think, and you really don't have time to think. And so I think, like, you know, it all just has to happen right then and come out right there. And like, you don't have time to guard yourself.
Was that frightening?
Yeah, it still is, because you just, you know, it's flop. You sort of either fail or you succeed in any moment doing that. It was terribly frightening, but I was good at it. I think just I didn't really have time to be something I wasn't in those moments. I've never really articulated it. It's nice to, but I think that was the case.
So how did you find Upright Citizens?
I found them because a friend took me to see an improv show there, and it was a two-person group. It was a gay man and a woman, and they had a show together called Guile.
Have you ever been to somebody else's party and the food was so divine?
Try this handy tip. Steal the food and serve it at your own party a few days later.
And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. To this day, I think the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it was a two-person group. In fact, the guy who was in it, his name's Elliot Lawrence, he wrote, and I'm friends with him now, he wrote that incredible movie. It wasn't like a huge release, but it was Kristen Wiig made a movie called Welcome to Me that's now on Netflix. It is one of the darkest, weirdest, funniest movies I've ever seen. It's called Welcome to Me, and it basically, Kristen Wiig stars as a woman who's obsessed with Oprah and who also suffers from mental illness. And she wins the lottery one day and decides she wants to have her own talk show a la Oprah Winfrey, but she just isn't able to handle it. And it's like, it's so inventive and weird and funny. And anyway, so I saw this two-person group, Guile, and just instantly was like, oh my God, that is the voice. That is what I want to do. And I signed up for classes immediately.
What was it that you wanted to do?
I think just really write and express my voice in a way that didn't have to be dramatic. Because at a place like NYU, it wasn't really pushing, you know, a comedy voice ever. It was, you know, it was always very serious. And it's certainly, once I got into the experimental theater wing there, they wanted you to really express yourself seriously. Expressing myself comedically felt like more like me, more like my voice, and was something I could take even more seriously because I got it and I knew it. And like, and it was, I mean, it really was the culmination of like the Big Business, the Sandra Bernhardt, Hairspray, the John Waters, all that stuff was really what I wanted to do and how I wanted to express myself.
So what kind of work did you start doing?
Writing my own shows. I would do, you know, sort of one-man shows of different characters and stuff like that. Did a ton of improv. did a two-person show with my dear friend Amy, who I then worked with at Funny or Die and then wrote with on the Ellen DeGeneres Show, and just really found my voice and finally figured out how to also, from that, with my voice, put pen to paper with it. How to write with being true to myself in that way. In a way that I really couldn't do it at school, even though that was part of the training.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like if you were going from experimental theater, which... I don't know. There's this stereotype that it's very dour and, like you say, serious.
Yes.
To doing characters and improv and sketches. That's such a 180.
No, it was. It was the thing. I think more than anything else, that's the thing that made me find my voice was and made me feel like this is something I'm really good at. And this is something that, you know, really makes me happy. And I think before, it's so funny because in acting school, the goal is to strip it all away from you. And I don't know that it necessarily did that for me.
Well, do you mean to strip away the voice?
To really what they want to do is like they the first year is all about grounding you sort of down to nothing, to make you as blank a slate as can be, to get rid of, which I guess is a good thing, but to get rid of every preconceived notion you have of like what acting is and, you know, what performance is, and to really, they want you to become a zero, and then they want to build you up to become a hero.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you had some things that needed to be shed, like that whole, like, oh, I'm just going to put on a show for everybody.
Yes. No, I did, except that it was just that classic thing of, like, I don't know that it ever really worked, because when I went up and tried to be serious in a scene or whatever, an acting class, I would just get laughs, not even meaning to, and just sort of being like, what is so funny? I am a serious actor. And I think a lot of people, my friend Drew Droege also has talked about this, that he always wanted to be taken so seriously, and it just didn't work. And so I think for me, yes, it was this stripping away stuff, but it didn't work. It just didn't, I'd go on stage and it was just sort of like, this guy is goofy, for even though he's trying not to be, which I think is even goofier.
Well, it's real you showing through.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So you're doing Upright Citizens then, and you said you found your voice. So what was that voice?
Oh, God. I think it really was just the irreverent, silly, stupid, and I don't know, hopefully smart. I think what I really have always tried to do, and certainly with Throwing Shade, the podcast I do, I always want to have really good points, and I want to find the dumbest way to get there, and just the stupidest, silliest thing, and then try to pack a punch at the end. And so I think that's always sort of been what I've tried to do. I love losers. I love people who are always racing to keep up with everyone else. I love people who feel like they have nowhere to turn. And I love making that funny.
Well, so tell me about the work that you started doing. You mentioned there were the sketches that you were doing and Funny or Die and Ellen.
And yeah, I mean, it all, just sort of the comic voice I had from doing Upright Citizens Brigade and also doing the Groundlings here in LA sort of just formed all that. And Funny or Die, it was great because that's, you know, essentially sketch writing. It's a writer staff and it's, you know, you're churning out videos every week. And that was as true to my voice at a paid job like that I've ever been, because they'd let you do anything you wanted. It just had to be funny. That was the only rule. And so I got to be weird and wacky and also just, I don't know, poke holes in things that I sort of loved doing. And there was free reign to do that. I think my favorite things I did there were, there was some crazy batshit letter that the leader of some sorority had written that was so beautifully written, but so mean. Talk about Heathers. It was so mean, and it was talking about how ugly the girls were that year and how embarrassed she was to be a Theta or whatever sorority. And I was like, wouldn't this be great if someone like Michael Shannon from Boardwalk Empire just performed this letter?
If you just open this like I told you to, tie yourself down to whatever chair you're sitting in, because this email is going to be a rough fucking ride. For those of you that have your heads under rocks, which apparently is the majority of this chapter, we have been fucking up in terms of nighttime events and general social interactions with Sigma Nu.
My friend David and I came up with this idea that I also loved, because I'm also obsessed with that show, The Bachelor. And I started thinking, like, why hasn't there ever been a gay bachelor? And my friend David said the same thing. And then we were like, oh, because in a house full of men like that, they would probably just, who knows if they would fall in love with the bachelor, they might fall in love with each other. And so we were like, Let's write that. And also another week of like, who do you hate this week? Nicholas Sparks. Great. Let's write a Nicholas Sparks parody. It was the best. And so that sort of was just free reign on doing whatever I wanted to do. And then Ellen was obviously very different because that was writing for someone else's voice. It was very sort of extreme differences there.
Yeah. It sounds like that's the kind of thing that you could only really do well once you find your own voice. I mean, if you went from having a persona to trying to write for someone else, it probably would come off a lot more falsely if you weren't secure in your own voice.
Matt, I feel like all I want to do is tell you everything going on with my life so that you can say one brilliant sentence. Because well, you're absolutely right. God, that's such a great piece of advice. Like, you really, and I know it's been said in many different forms, but you really can't. Really, it's like, RuPaul always says that thing about, how are you going to love someone else if you can't love yourself? It's the same thing. How are you going to write for someone else if you don't know your own voice? It's absolutely true.
How are you going to write for Ellen if you haven't written for Funny or Die?
Listen, if I ever have my own reality competition show, it won't have anything to do with writing, but I'm still going to say that sentence.
And people will be like, oh, yes, that's so wise. And then they'll turn to each other and be like, I don't know what that means.
What the hell did that mean? Yeah, exactly.
There's this is such a terrible reference. Do you know this movie, The Master of Disguise?
Yes, I do. But, I've never seen it, but I know what it is. Is it the thing where he goes, do I look turtly enough?
Yeah, so he goes, am I not turtly enough? That's me.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I've seen this movie so many times because it is the dumbest, worst, most terrible comedy ever. These two characters, these two major villains, it's the villain and the hero, are talking to each other via television because one of them has hijacked the television network. And he says something that makes no sense because it's a dumb comedy and it's like this weird thing about the disguisey family and how he's stealing the artifacts.
Oh my god, I'm watching it tonight, by the way.
Okay, it's just the most bizarre movie. He says this thing that makes no sense to anybody. He says it to this character on this international broadcast, and then it cuts away to everybody nodding knowingly at this thing around the world, like, ah, yes. It also, gosh, that film, it has exactly one funny joke, and it is someone carrying a plate of spaghetti and tripping and throwing the plate of spaghetti, and then it cuts away to the person he's thrown it to, and they have spaghetti for hair and meatballs for eyes. That is the one
that is amazing
funny gag.
Yeah. I mean, Dana Carvey's brilliant, and maybe this movie is a total disaster, but it's you have only sold it to me, by the way.
Good. I recommend, so I worked in a video store when it came out on DVD, and so not only did I watch the movie, but I watched the commentary, which is Dana Carvey explaining and apologizing for all of the jokes that are not landing.
Oh, that's amazing. Have you ever heard the commentary? Carrie Fisher does the commentary on Postcards from the Edge. Have you ever?
No, I didn't know that. Oh, my God.
She does the commentary. And by the way, she's like not watching the movie. The microphone turns on and she's like, hi. So listen, it's so. And then occasionally she'll look up and she'll be like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah. So this. Anyway, and just like, it's amazing. You have to watch it.
Oh my
God. It's just as good as the movie, if not better.
You know, that it's, I love that it's like just a completely separate, it's just a night with Carrie.
It is. And it like, to the point where you're like, well, I guess she's just in a room recording or a stream of consciousness and then you, like a little bit through the movie, you're like, oh no, she's watching it. She's just not watching it.
I just want to have her do commentary for every movie.
Oh man, she's the best. Have you seen that show Catastrophe on Amazon?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
It's only 6 episodes and it is so good. And she plays one of the Rob Delaney's character's mother. And she's phenomenal.
When she popped up on an episode of 30 Rock, and my partner and I both literally squealed when we saw her.
Yeah. I hope she knows how appreciated she still is, because she's the best.
Oh, she's got it. And well, so tell me about the work that you do now.
Yeah. So I have a podcast called Throwing Shade with my dear friend, Aaron Gibson. Aaron and I met at Upright Citizens Brigade. And then we worked on a show together called Infomania, which was on a tiny network called Current TV. I had a segment on there called That's Gay that looked at how sort of gay people and gayness is treated and perceived by the media.
It's become a familiar story this year. Teens who want to go to prom with a same-sex date but are met with resistance from their schools. It's like Footloose if Kevin Bacon was fighting for basic human rights.
And then Aaron had one doing the same thing for women. And then that show was canceled. And so we were sort of like, well, that was really fun to talk about all this stuff. We should just keep talking about it completely uncensored and just be as silly as we want to. And so then we got into the podcast game. And our tagline sort of is that we treat issues affecting women and gay people with much less respect than they deserve, which is essentially what we do. I take a look at an issue affecting gay people. She takes a look at an issue affecting women, and we just, you know, bully the bullies, make fun of it, go on just wild, weird tangents, and get to really, I mean, that to me is really just using my voice in the most uncensored, in the way I love. And so it comes out weekly every Thursday.
You're saying, like, after you came out, that zero fucks given sort of
Yeah. Sometimes people will send us emails about quoting stuff we've said, and I'm just horrified and tickled. So it is all those things. But to me, it's really just the most fun I have every week. So it's
great. And you know, if you're adopting this approach of don't think,
yeah,
great.
Hey, that's absolutely happening on that show. It's rare that I laugh at some stuff I say myself, and sometimes I find myself doing it on that, and there's nothing grosser, but also I'm having a blast. So
some of my favorite segments on there are when you're doing the Max Fun Drive stuff and Paris Milan. I live for Paris Milan.
Yeah, it's a character who I don't know the gender, to tell you the truth. I've never really, I think Aaron's even asked me, and I've just avoided the question. But yeah, just the richest person on the planet. She's constantly, or he is constantly traveling, going on adventures and doing just crazy stuff that costs billions of dollars. I love, this is the John Waters thing that I love. I love when he makes fun of people who have money or think they have it. Like, I love that moment in Serial Mom when Kathleen Turner compliments someone at a PTA meeting and it's like, oh, I like your cardigan. And she goes, thank you. It's Liz Claiborne. I love it. It's so great. It's such a disgusting thing to say. And
hi, Betty.
Oh, hi, Beverly.
Oh, I love your outfit.
Oh, thanks. Hi. Liz Claiborne.
And so I love characters who just think they're rich. I think that's so fun.
It's not just all character work, obviously, because you're literally talking about, like, issues of the day.
Exactly. In fact, like, we do the character work not even once a month, but it is mostly just us, talking, like you said, talking about issues of the day. And nothing is more terrifying than when people say to us, I get all the news of the week from you. I'm like, that is dangerous. That the nut of it is a real story happening, but the rest of it is craziness.
Sure. Well, it's like you said, that thing of getting to making a smart point and getting to it in the dumbest way you can.
That's what we do. And it really is, like, I think that the thing we always strive for is comedy first, message second. We always want to, at least I always want to be funny first.
So, and you know, what strikes me is that we started by talking about Big Business and how it's this kooky, silly, fun movie that actually does have a really sweet heart at the center of it. And, you know, it too, like Throwing Shade, has a little bit of seriousness and a little bit of, you know, we're a loveliness to it.
Yes.
That is surrounded by zaniness.
Absolutely. Like, I think one of the major messages of that is staying true to yourself and loving who you are and being okay with it.
It's a message you've taken to heart. You're living Big Business.
I'm living Big Business. That's right.
You've been to New York. You're being yourself now.
I run a pharmaceutical company. Yeah, it's going great.
Now just put on some lipstick in the mirror and you're done.
Exactly. I still haven't met my identical twin. So if he's out there, hit me up.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks again to Brian for joining me. I highly recommend him and Aaron's show, Throwing Shade, and you must drop everything to go see them live on their 21-city tour. Tickets are at throwingshade.com/tour. I'll confess that when I first started listening to Throwing Shade, I would get a little frustrated when one of them got a fact wrong or broached a topic with what I thought was insufficient gravity. But being silly is kind of the point of a comedy show, and if you try to take it seriously, well, then you're the one the joke's on. Generally speaking, the more seriously you take yourself, the funnier you actually are. For my recommendation this week, take a look at the book A Confederacy of Dunces, written by John Kennedy Toole in the 1960s. It's the story of a man who considers himself very important, and is, in fact, very ridiculous. His name's Ignatius Riley, and he's by turns a hot dog vendor, a pants manufacturer, a revolutionary, and a masturbator. His grasp on reality is not the strongest, but his plans are terribly grand. For example, one day, while dressed as a pirate, Ignatius makes the acquaintance of a gay man named Dorian Green. As Ignatius learns about the basic tenets of homosexuality, it occurs to him that he might be able to achieve world peace by infiltrating the nation's army with gay men, transforming all future wars from conflicts into orgies. He commands that Dorian assemble all of his gay friends for what he expects will be a political rally, but what winds up being somewhat less sober. This is but one of many memorable escapades in the book, all of which involve Ignatius's increasingly grandiose plans and increasingly chaotic failures. The title is a reference to a Jonathan Swift quote: "When a true genius appears, you can know him by this sign that all the dunces are in a confederacy against him." For Ignatius, this explains everything. All of his failures simply confirm his genius and motivate him to attempt ever more serious endeavors. When things aren't going as you might have planned, you basically have two choices. You can either panic about your wounded pride and convince yourself that the world's out to get you, or you can just laugh about being wrong. And you might as well laugh, because expecting that you're going to be right about everything is funny. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who's voted for The Sewers of Paris in the GLBT category at podcastawards.com. Voting's open for a few more days, so please go vote, and then vote again every day. It's a great chance to highlight some fantastic LGBT voices and bring in some more listeners for the amazing episodes that are coming up in 2016. Just go to podcastawards.com, look for GLBT, and choose The Sewers of Paris. Thanks also to everyone supporting The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. You might have noticed this episode is particularly heavy with clips, and I'm able to spend the time to track those clips down because of the support of the fabulous listeners who've pledged as little as a dollar an episode. You can join them. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. You can also leave a review of the show on iTunes. I'm just two reviews away from my 200th review. And if you have any thoughts on today's episode, please get in touch. Tweet at me at Matt Baum. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com for more clips of the stuff that we talked about on today's show. And please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make such a huge difference. Check out my book, Defining Marriage, now out in paperback, an audiobook, and ebook. You can find it at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.